yet another byproduct. In his book Social Evolution, Robert Trivers enlarged on his 1976 evolutionary theory of self-deception. Self-deception is
hiding the truth from the conscious mind, the better to hide it from others. In our own species, we recognize that shifty eyes, sweaty palms, and croaky voices may indicate the stress that accompanies conscious knowledge of attempted deception. By becoming unconscious of its deception, the deceiver hides these signs from the observer. He or she can lie without the nervousness that accompanies deception.
The anthropologist Lionel Tiger says something similar in Optimism, the Biology of Hope. The connection to the sort of constructive irrationality we've just been discussing is seen in Trivers's paragraph about perceptual defence.
There is a tendency for humans consciously to see what they wish to see. They literally have difficulty seeing things with negative connotations while seeing, with increasing ease, items that are positive. For example, words that evoke anxiety, either because of an individual's personal history or because of experimental manipulation, require greater illumination before first being perceived.
The relevance of this to the wishful thinking of religion should need no spelling out. The general theory of religion as an accidental byproduct, a misfiring of something useful, is the one I wish to advocate. The details are various, complicated, and disputable. For the sake of illustration, I shall continue to use my gullible child theory as representative of byproduct theories in general. This theory, that the child brain is, for good reasons, vulnerable to infection by mental viruses, will strike some readers as incomplete. Vulnerable the mind may be, but why should it be infected by this virus rather than that? Are some viruses especially proficient at infecting vulnerable minds? Why does infection manifest itself as religion rather than as, well, what? Part of what I want to say is that it doesn't matter what particular style of nonsense infects the child brain. Once infected, the child will grow up and infect the next generation with the same nonsense, whatever it happens to be.
An anthropological survey, such as Fraser's Golden Bough, impresses us with the diversity of irrational human beliefs. Once entrenched in a culture, they persist, evolve, and diverge in a manner reminiscent of biological evolution. Yet Fraser discerns certain general principles, for example, homeopathic magic, whereby spells and incantations borrow some symbolic aspect of the real-world object they're intended to influence. An instance with tragic consequences is the belief that powdered rhinoceros horn has aphrodisiac properties. Fatuous as it is, the legend stems from the horn's supposed resemblance to a virile penis. The fact that homeopathic magic is so widespread suggests that the nonsense that infects vulnerable brains is not entirely random, arbitrary nonsense. It is tempting to pursue the biological analogy to the point of wondering whether something corresponding to natural selection is at work. Are some ideas more spreadable than others because of intrinsic appeal or merit or compatibility with existing psychological dispositions? And could this account for the nature and properties of actual religions as we see them in something like the way we use natural selection to account for living organisms? It is important to understand that merit here means only ability to survive and spread. It doesn't mean deserving of a positive value judgment, something of which we might be humanly proud. Even on an evolutionary model, there doesn't have to be any natural selection. Biologists acknowledge that a gene may spread through a population not because it is a good gene, but simply because it is a lucky one. We call this genetic drift. How important it is vis-à-vis natural selection has been controversial, but it is now widely accepted in the form of the so-called neutral theory of molecular genetics. If a gene mutates to a different version of itself, which has an identical effect, the difference is neutral, and selection cannot favour one or the other. Nevertheless, by what statisticians call sampling error over generations, the new mutant form can eventually replace the original form in the gene pool. This is a true evolutionary change at the molecular level, even if no change is observed in the world of whole organisms. It is a neutral, evolutionary change that owes nothing to selective advantage.